Alrighty then, here we go. Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Hello, I'm Rick Moore, along with Josh Arnold. Our producer and engineer is Bill Proposky. On this Friday, February something or other. Morning.
Good morning.
What's going on?
Well, we're getting a storm this weekend, but I guess we're going to get mostly rain. But up your way, up north, I think they're going to get some snow.
Well, that's what we're talking about. I hope so. Got a couple of ski days in already. I'm looking forward to another one. Lots going on in the area, lots going on nationally. Some really stupid stuff nationally, but that's a story for another day. What's going on locally?
Well, I have our first guest today is going to be Afros Khan, who's a city councilor in Newburyport.
You've talked with him before, right?
Her.
Oh, okay. I think of someone else up there.
Okay. And Beth Gerard, the city council president in Salem, will be our second guest. And David DiArcangelo, the director of Massachusetts Office of Disabilities, will be our third guest.
Okay. That's all upcoming here this morning on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. We'll be back.
Get the skills you need to be a leader in sports and recreation. A master's in athletic administration from Endicott's Van Loan School prepares students for careers in schools, government agencies, nonprofit organizations, sports governing bodies, private sports clubs, and more. Van Loan's athletic administration master's program is 100% online with affordable tuition. Try a class before fully enrolling. Visit vanloan.endicott.edu/athleticadmin today.
People come in, take a seat, you're really in for a treat at Sylvan Street. A great place to eat and drink and meet with family and friends at Sylvan Street. We'll treat you right, day or night, satisfy your appetite. Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Catch a game with friends, meet for lunch, cocktails after work, or a romantic dinner for two. Whatever your plan to do it at Sylvan Street Grill in Peabody and Salisbury. See you at Sylvan Street.
Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Follow North Shore Sports at msonewsports.com. Live radio game coverage of the top local games. Feature interviews with players and coaches, both audio and videos. Join us Monday nights at 7 for North Shore Sports Night, an hour of local sports talk with featured guests. For scores, photos, radio and video interviews, live game coverage, spread the word. Check out msonewsports.com. Follow us on Twitter and get our easy-to-use mobile app, msonewsports.com.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our first guest is City Councilor from Newburyport, Afros Khan. Afros, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Well, great. We usually start out and ask folks first time here, give us a little bio, 3 or 4 minutes, and tell us a little about you, and then we can get into some questions about the work you're doing in Newburyport.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. So my name's Afros Khan, and I've been here in Newburyport since 2005. When I moved here with my husband. We were living in Boston before, but I've kind of been all over the country. I was born and raised in Chicago and then moved with my family to California in my teen years. And then I did go up to Alaska, and my father took a job up in Anchorage. And then I did go to college in Fairbanks, Alaska, which is another story for another day. And then grad school in upstate New York, and made my way over here to the New England area.
Great.
So I'm an electrical engineer. So I work in energy efficiency. So I've been working in that field for over 20 years and have been very active in our town here in Newburyport with the parent teacher organization and some other efforts too, community efforts.
Great. What are some of the things that you were involved in, and what prompted you to run for city council?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would, working in energy efficiency, a lot of the things I'm interested in conservation, even at the grassroots levels in terms of what we could do in our own homes. And so anytime Newburyport had efforts for any pilot, we would jump right onto that. So, for example, we had this incentive from the state to install solar panels. So that was done in 2012. So we went ahead and signed up for that, and we've been now generating power in the summer, which has been wonderful, and seeing how conservation really works firsthand. And then we also in Newburyport did a pilot on composting, and we also participated in that last year, and it was really eye-opening to see how much reduction of just garbage happens when you compost and recycle together. You have less than even a quarter of a bag of garbage weekly, and so that was, again, something I see as a big opportunity. It was a pilot, but it's not yet a city service.
Okay. My father was a landscape gardener, and we composted, and, you know, where I grew up in East Gloucester, great growing soil. When I moved to other places, when I got married and so forth, not so much luck. So there's a lot to what comes out of that. So you ran for city council and you got elected. Tell us about what you do there. I know that you have standing committees or subcommittees that people serve on. What do you serve on as a city councilor, and what's on the agenda for Newburyport these days?
So I ran for city councilor at large. We have 11 city councilors here in Newburyport, 5 of which are at large, and I am a first time public service city councilor, I guess. I don't know how you say that, but I am a first-time member of the city council, and it was a very exciting time to run and be part of the process of going door-to-door and talking to a lot of the people here in Newburyport. And so what we do is we get assigned to committees, and my two committees are budget and finance, as well as joint education. And I think those are really excellent committees for me. I have my two girls have been in the Newburyport Public Schools since they were young, and I have one in middle school now and one in elementary. And then for budget and finance, I've been treasurer for other boards, and I have a sense of some of that background, which was, I think, really appropriate for what I'm doing. In terms of what are some of the items on our agenda, there's quite a bit going on in Newburyport. We're really at a pivotal point in terms of development versus retention of some of the historical aspects of our city, and then also being mindful as other things are happening at the state level, how that's going to affect us. And, you know, for example, and I think you've had other speakers in the city talk about the Cannabis Control Commission, who's going to be having the regulations out soon, and how that's really affecting all the cities and communities around the state. So that's something that we know is on the horizon, and our mayor did put a moratorium on any efforts until November for the recreational. Medical is already kind of alive and is being zoned in our city. But other things, too, is we senior tax exemption. We did talk about how we could provide more relief to community people here in Newburyport who are really struggling to be able to stay in their home as we see the rising costs in property taxes. So we did have something already right at the Budget and Finance Committee to look at exemptions and going to maybe a city vote to adopt certain exemptions.
And based on how it's developing, how would that work? Is that simply people in a certain income would get a discount if they could show that they didn't have sufficient funds or their income was at a certain level, or is it more expansive than that? That they maybe would do some volunteer work or some work that contributed to some service, and as a result of that, they would get a tax break.
Well, and so it's all of that.
Okay.
So it is, I'm finding myself becoming an expert in this area, mainly because just wanting to make sure we understand what's available and then how that's being communicated. So there's programs at the state level that can be applied in the municipalities or the cities based on what the city adopts within a category of requirements. So in Newburyport, for example, a popular clause that many municipalities have is called Clause 41C, which really has a set income limit for qualifying seniors, 65 and older, and then it has an asset limit and then an assistance amount, you know, $500 to $1,000. What we did find, though, is there were not many many people in Newburyport taking advantage of it. There was only 49, I think, last year that actually qualified. So our mayor and her team and the city worked hard to look at what are some other ways to provide assistance, and there is an option on something called 41C and a half, which increases the income limit. And then it does things where there is no asset limit. So it's not the perfect system, but it's something that does require, if you are going to adopt it, you actually go to election. You go to a municipal election in your city to make sure that everybody is in favor of that. But part of this process, I realize, and then we do have a work program, but, you know, going to the bigger picture is I think a lot of it comes down to education and people knowing what's available to them. So I applaud some of the efforts in Amesbury where they are doing a survey. They have an online survey that they're asking all the seniors to fill out so they can really identify what they know, what they don't know, and what they really need. And I'm all about, you know, tapping into constituents and getting feedback, whether it's in small forums or through SurveyMonkey or something, to hear from people.
Okay. Is the one of the issues that comes up at from town to town is housing, and there's a shortage of supply in some communities, and you have a situation where perhaps somebody grew up in Newburyport, they've lived there all their life, they want to downsize, but there may not be the availability to downsize and still stay in Newburyport. Is that an issue that you've run into? And what are some of the issues or challenges that Newburyport faces in terms of housing?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. That is an issue, and it's one of the things that it's a lot more complicated than when we realize it, because it comes down to the zoning aspect as well, and
yeah,
how we are zoning. And Newburyport is really becoming a very, I don't know how to say it. I mean, it's an attractive and amazing city, but we definitely do see areas where what was a lot for one home might then be parsed into two homes, and each one of them over $1 million. And that's really been hurting that market of people who want to come and, you know, live in Newburyport but can't afford it. And I feel like I really applaud the efforts of the city council even before I got on, who really recognized that and started looking at how we are doing our zoning requirements and who's the zoning enforcement arm, and making sure that's done in a transparent but also in a fair manner. And we also, you know, affordable housing is a big area too that we want to make sure that Newburyport has a good stock of, and that's always the conversation. Anytime there is a new construction happening, multifamily is trying to see if they could go at least 12%, if not more. And I still think 12% is not enough. And we do have an incredible opportunity right now with a school that has been no longer, it's being repurposed for another use, and we're looking at that as a place to really have affordable housing up to 60% if possible over there. So it is something we're really cognizant of, and I have to tell you, I really applaud the efforts of everyone who that's in the forefront of their mind as we are, each department, as we're looking at projects.
Great. Now, you mentioned we were talking about the marijuana issue, and most cities and towns are struggling with it in terms of zoning, in terms of not knowing. The state has not is coming out with some more guidelines probably the middle of March of this year. Is any part of the effort in Newburyport to perhaps put a panel together of people from different neighboring cities, so that you might tap into what Amesbury or Salem or Beverly or Danvers are doing and kind of compare notes? Is that something that you guys have thought about or might consider?
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. And I feel like we've started some of those conversations. I had I believe some of your other attendees went to the Massachusetts Municipal Association meeting, which was held in the middle of January in Boston. And it was, I have to tell you, the networking even there with other municipal leaders in the other cities was very eye-opening. The other thing that I think is fantastic is that the Cannabis Control Commission is doing public hearings, one of which was supposed to actually be this past Wednesday, but because of the snow, it's actually on February 14th, and it's going to be in Danvers. And so these are great opportunities to go with our fellow colleagues in other cities and attend them as well. So I do encourage, you know, on the website, there are all these public hearing dates that they're doing, and if anyone's in that area to really attend is important. And from there, I think we're all going to face the same struggles and same issues. And so I think you're absolutely right with making sure we're talking to each other.
One of the issues that Paul Lumberg, the city council president in Gloucester, was discussing with us a couple of weeks ago was this notion that what do you do with the money? And a thing that hasn't been really brought front and center in all communities is that any federally insured bank is prohibited from accepting money that's the result of drug sales that are prohibited under federal law. So even though the state law says, yeah, you can do this, there's an economic piece that is just kind of hanging out there, and I'm wondering if your community is certainly aware of it, but has that been part of the debate in Newburyport?
Well, yeah, no, you're absolutely. It is actually very interesting to see how that's going to play out, because that is a really interesting nuance within these regulations. But our city has really been focusing on the education aspect, mainly for our youth. And I think that's been one thing that at least we saw with, as I mentioned, there is an opportunity for medical, for example, medical marijuana. And some of the industries or businesses coming are earmarking funds towards educational programs. And I think part of what I see this as an opportunity is to build a more robust educational component for the kids and for other families on how we're going to really work together as we introduce maybe another aspect into our city that does have a tendency to perhaps be abused or lead to, you know, you always hear that there could be some, you know, the developing brain and how the use of this drug can really affect that. So I do think holding the businesses and the companies that are going to come to earmarking funds towards that better good and education or social worker and funding some of that, that to me is something that I see as an opportunity.
You brought up a very good point, and that is, you know, we've traditionally in schools had a drug education program, and clearly marijuana, use of marijuana by children or adults, has been not encouraged, and more than that. Now the state law changes, and it's okay to use it. But the trickle down or the other impact issues that creates for communities, in terms of curriculum, in terms of economics, and how do you spend or use the money, or how do you zone it? There's a lot left open there that wasn't part of the original bill.
Right.
Yeah, and that happens a lot in government. It's not just this particular issue. Somebody at a different level passes legislation without really field testing what the solution is and how many problems that then creates.
Right, okay. Exactly. And, you know, I know there are states we could look to, for example, but I don't think even then, like, for example, Colorado, people always say, well, let's see what they've done, but I think the data is still kind of coming in based on what they've put in place. And so, yeah, you're right. The laws get made or we start moving in a direction, but there's still all these different aspects that have to come along with it and come up to speed.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Certainly wish you the very best of success in your new role as the counselor at large in Newburyport. And maybe when we get a few months into your term, we can have you back and talk about how some of these issues are being approached and resolved.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me. Pleasure talking with you.
Take care. Thank you. Bye.
All right. You too. Bye.
Stronger, faster, tougher. When you need the MVP of community banks, look no further than the Institution for Savings, with 14 full-service offices throughout the North Shore. We have MVP rates and an all-star team to serve you. Bank from the ball field with our 24/7 online application apps, internet banking, mobile deposit, and more. Institution for Savings, your winning team. Visit institutionforsavings.com, member FDIC, DIF, equal housing lender.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. Our company has been proud to have supported high school sports on the North Shore for more than 30 years. Our student-athlete program recognizes championship performance in the classroom and on the field. Moynihan Lumber is also committed to championship performance when it comes to meeting all your building and home improvement needs. And if you're planning to change your kitchen, please visit our kitchen cabinet showrooms at any of our three locations, in Beverly, North Reading, or Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at moynihanlumber.com.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is Beth Gerard, who is the City Council President in Salem, Massachusetts. Beth, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Josh.
Well, it's I know you're busy, lots of things happening in Salem. Maybe we'd start with, I know you've been on the show in the past, but just give us a 3 or 4 minute bio about yourself, and then we can get into some questions about all the good things and controversial things that are going on in Salem.
Sure. So I've lived on the North Shore most of my life. I grew up in Revere and Marblehead, and my husband and I have been in Salem now the last 13 years. I have a background in health policy and analysis, and my day job, actually, I work at Salem Hospital as an analyst, and I've been in healthcare for, God, 18 years now. And I've just always been a lifelong volunteer, and so it seemed like with the policy experience and the volunteering experience that a sort of career, a part-time career in local politics made sense. So in 2013, I decided that I would just try to run for city council, and I actually won, and I've been here ever since.
Great.
Won't get rid of me.
Good. And this year, they made you city council president.
Yes.
So tell us about that.
Sure. Being president is really fascinating. So I, as the president, so I have to keep the decorum for the meetings. I choose where people sit in chambers. I choose the committees, who's going to staff the committees and who's going to chair the committees, as well as assigning any liaisons to any other boards or committees, because in Salem we have probably about 30 other committees. And then the other kind of interesting thing is that whenever the mayor leaves the state, I'm acting mayor. So I kind of hope she doesn't go away on vacation ever.
And is that if she has to, if she goes somewhere for more than a certain period of time, or?
No, it's whenever she leaves the state.
Really? Wow.
Whenever she goes on vacation out of state, then I become acting mayor. But really, that it's not as exciting as it sounds. Essentially, I just have to sign everybody's paycheck.
Sign the warrant and approve the bills. And yeah, you can't do anything substantive while she's gone. But
No, nothing with permanence.
Yeah, all right. So you mentioned that you appoint the committees. I know that Salem has, the city council has an administration and finance committee, a community and economic development, government services, ordinances, license and legal affairs, public health and safety and environment. Well, it's an interesting blend of different disciplines. How do you go about, how did you go about as the city council president selecting which councilors would sit on which committee? Did they give input of where they'd like to be, or did you look and say, well, this one's a CPA, or this one has a real financial background, we need that person on finance? Or how did that play out?
That's exactly what I did. So the councilors gave me their wish list of the committees that they wanted to serve on, and if they wanted to be a chair of one of the committees. And then I also looked at their backgrounds as well. So, like, I know for me, example, when I first got on, and I remember I was talking with the city solicitor, and she said, hey, so what committee do you want to be on? And I said, hey, you know, I'd like to try ordinances, licenses, and legal affairs, because that's outside my wheelhouse. And the council president that year was Bob McCarthy, who's the Ward 1 counselor. He put me on administration and finance, which that was actually perfect for me, because that is a big part of my background. And So, and I just absolutely fell in love with administration and finance. So I wanted to put people on committees where, A, I wanted to make sure that things got done. You know, one of the, there was an article in the Salem News last year about how things had gotten log jammed in one of the committees. And so I wanted to make sure that I had really robust chairs and that I had diverse backgrounds on my committee so that I knew that things could get done and hard questions would be asked.
Good. And how do you, as council president, I know that in cities, if somebody brings up an issue in Salem, and I'm guessing this is the process, somebody brings in a new order, it might be heard at the council level and then referred out to committee. Is that, and then the committee comes back with a report. So as these things come in and they get designated to the different committee structure, how do you maintain a dialogue with committee chairs about, you know, what the status is coming out of committee, when it's coming out of committee, and then use that to figure what the agenda is going to be for the city council meeting, or how does that go?
Somewhat. So I don't want to be a de facto chair of any of the committees. I want them to run their own committees, and I'm trusting them to get whatever the topic is that's coming in to get that done. So when something comes in, so for example, in our, not last night's meeting, but the meeting before, so Councilor Madore, who's the, Christine Madore is our Ward 2 counselor, she brought in an order to look at some valet parking for some spots down in Riley Plaza, and so she initially reached out to me and said, hey, can we pass this on the floor? And I said, I don't think that should be passed on the floor. Why don't you talk to the chair of Ordinance, Licenses, and Legal Affairs, or talk to the chair of Community and Economic Development and get that into their committee? Because really what should be happening, like last night we had a marathon meeting night, and we can talk about that later, but really what should be happening in a council meeting, this is just supposed to be housekeeping. All of the work should be happening in the committee. So ideally, if there's something that comes up that any counselor could have even a question about, that should just be sent to committee.
Okay, great. Yeah, I know that, I worked in public administration for about 15 years, most of it in the last century. So, but night meetings were vast and long. I mean, I had probably 14 or 15 committees that I had a liaison responsibility to. So I was out every night of the week. Yep. And some of them, you know, I felt like the analogy that I used, and you may not appreciate this, but was that for certain committees, it was like watching Wagon Train. Every week there was an episode, but it was not clearly got anywhere. And you know, 23 meetings of the policy committee, and they changed one policy. That was, like, in my view, kind of a waste of time. But but there's also that phenomenon that for some people, it's a night out. How do you deal with trying to keep things moving so you don't, so the things get done, and it's not just a night out for some people?
Well, you know, again, this is where I go back to who I pointed to my committee chairs that, and I talked with them about this, and I said, hey, I'd really like it if you could be committee chair for this particular committee because, and one of your jobs, you have to keep in mind, we have to keep things moving along. And, you know, when I was committee chair, I was chair of administration and finance, and I would go over things like with the finance director before I was presenting something at council so that I didn't want to bring anything into committee unless it absolutely had to go to committee. So, and I try to encourage that as much as possible. But again, it's like trying to find the right balance of not being an overarching president, but also letting them get it done, but making sure they get it done.
Supporting your chairs, in other words.
Say that again?
Supporting your chairs.
Yes. Exactly.
So, but you mentioned controversy. You mentioned last night's meeting. Let's talk about that. What happened last night? I know that the marijuana issues is certainly an issue there. It's an issue, it seems like, most cities and towns on the North Shore. Tell me about Salem's ventures into this water.
Well, so Salem voted overwhelmingly in favor. I think it was a little over 60% to allow for recreational marijuana facilities. And so now we're trying to figure out how can we zone for this? Because if we don't make some zoning decisions, then it's essentially just carte blanche, and anybody can set up a shop wherever there's a retail district. So we really wanted to hammer this out and figure out how to get it done and make sure that we had some local control over this. And so it initially started with a joint public hearing with the planning board, and then the planning board, then with joint public hearings, it's this clock that starts. So this clock started back in September, and we had to make a decision before February 27th, or else it had to all start all over again. So we had, so the joint public hearing was in, I think it was like October, November, and then from there we had to make a decision. And so then it went to the Ordinances, Licenses, and Legal Affairs Committee, and they had about a 2.5-3 hour meeting earlier this week, and then they made a decision, so it was coming out to the floor to be further discussed. And so then this turned into a long discussion, and really the discussion centered around where the Ordinances, Licenses, and Legal Affairs Committee, which we all just call it OLA, O-L-L-A, so OLA. So OLA decided that they wanted it just to be in the B5 district, which our police chief had serious concerns about it just being located in one place. Because the other thing to keep in mind is that with the state regulations, we can have up to 20% of our liquor licenses can be for recreational marijuana facilities. So we can have up to 4 marijuana facilities potentially. And at last night's meeting, there were a couple of gentlemen who were there that said, hey, we're really interested in doing this. And so the planning board had recommended our B2 zone, B4, B5, BPD, Business Park Development, and then industrial. And so the OLA committee said, no, we don't want it in B2. We don't want it anywhere near any residences. And then one of the counselors who has Salem State in his ward said, Salem State doesn't want it anywhere near them. And so then this turned into essentially the volleying and the back and forth. And so it was probably a good... Probably our meeting was 4.5 hours last night, so it was probably a good 2.5 of that meeting.
NIMBY politics, not in my backyard. But people are in favor of it, but they don't want it set up in their backyard. They want it across town somewhere.
Right, and I think that this is what I think is concerning people a bit, because I think people are worried about maybe on-site consumption, perhaps, but that's not allowed in our state law right now. So this is really just selling. And so one of the concerns was that the Ward 7 counselor had expressed concerns about having a 1,000-foot buffer from any kids or playgrounds or I think religious structures as well. And in my ward, in Ward 6 in North Salem, we have a medical marijuana facility. And when medical marijuana facilities were regulated and developed by Department of Public Health and with the state legislature, they said a 500-foot buffer. Now, where the facility is in my ward, it's over 500 feet from the nearest playground and nearest, it's the Children and Families that's near there, but it's not within it's less than 1,000 feet from both of those areas, the playground and the Children and Families building. And so this was concerning, that if we change it and we go above what the state is requesting, A, we're outside of what the state said, because the state specifically said you can make it less than the 500 feet, but you can't make it over the 500 feet. Uh-huh. And so this turned into a long discussion with the mayor, the police chief, our assistant city solicitor, who kept explaining over and over again that we really can't go above the 500 feet. And so we ended up overall going with the 500-foot buffer and then also bringing it back to the B2 district, because we have so many B2 districts. So, like, for example, a B2 district is Highland Avenue, and in speaking with the mayor about this and speaking with the police chief about this, I said, hey, you know what, if we're treating this like these are package stores, we have a package store on Highland Ave. So what are they saying? Are these counselors that are against the B2 saying, oh, well, if we could have our druthers, if we could do it all over again, we wouldn't even have a package store on Highland Ave? I don't think they would say that. So we, thankfully, we did get the B2 back.
Okay.
So, and for the most part, other than around Salem State, we have the 500-foot buffer.
Question, as you've been talking, it occurs to me, you said about Salem State. So a young student goes to Salem State, they have an off-campus apartment, and they set up a shop and say, well, I'm going to pay for my college education selling marijuana. And so I'm going to advertise on the internet, and I'm guessing the zoning is not going to allow that, but has anybody thought that that's going to happen?
Well, you know what? If they're within 500 feet or if they're within 1,000 feet of Salem State, that would be a problem. If they're within 1,000 or 500 feet of a school, a place of worship, that would be a problem. And if they're outside of the B2 or the B5, the business park development or the industrial zone, that would be a problem. But anything else that, as long as it meets those requirements, and again, there's so many other requirements that they have to set up a host agreement with the city. So it's not like once we made this decision tonight, then, hey, open up the floodgates for those four potential recreational marijuana facilities to come in, retailers to come in. So there's still a lot more work that has to happen. So, I mean, it would be a lot of work. I feel like that might be a good capstone project for a business major or something, but otherwise it would be a long, long project to get that done.
Great.
And it's going to be.
What else is up and going on in Salem? I know that's always a busy city, and lots of, you get a new senior facility that's being built, and how is that coming? And I know, well, one of the things that I had been reading about Salem was the working with housing, and I know that there was, I believe there was a long-range study. It said that by 2028, the amount of elderly people or people above the age of 60 was going to be up to around 12 or 14,000, and that created all kinds of challenges for housing, infrastructure, and transportation. How is the city wrestling with those issues, assuming my numbers are even remotely correct?
Yeah, I think I know what study you're referring to. It was the MAPC that had given us, shared a study with the city that said, hey, you know, by 2030, we're going to be 15% under what we need for housing. And so we're keeping this in mind as we're thinking about affordable housing now. Salem has a requirement for any new development that they have to make everything, have to make every development 10% affordable housing. And we are also looking at developing what the mayor's calling like a circulator that will be a local shuttle that will take people around the city as well. You know, because as you know, and as you pointed out, you know, Salem's a hot happening city, so we end up having a lot of traffic. And so ways to alleviate that traffic, you know, we're looking at developing our bike path system more. Like last night, we voted to rename a section of the bike path from Riley Plaza to the Marblehead Line for our former mayor, Tony Salvo, who had passed away this past year. And then in terms of other things that we're working on with housing, like we're always trying to come up with ways to find, it's like we're trying to find the right balance, because we don't want to overdevelop, but we want to make sure that people can live here and people can afford to live here. And it's not unique to Salem, but that's always going to be the challenge. I mean, Salem is hot. It amazes me how much houses are going for in my neighborhood and around the city. And largely the reason for that is because the supply is so low. So if the supply is so low, then we're not going to have enough housing for people that want to come live here. And as you mentioned with the senior center, we're going to have affordable housing with the senior center. And actually, I drive by that every morning on my way to work, and it's fantastic seeing that project coming along, because to get to this point now is really exciting.
Great, great. Well, I mean, the good news on the one hand is that you're doing such a good job running the city that everybody wants to live there. The problem is that because everybody wants to live there, you just don't have quite enough space yet.
Right.
Great. Well, that's good. Let me just see what we're doing. I want to thank you for being a guest on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Certainly lots of things happening in Salem, and as we talked before, we're going to have you back every once a month or every other month to kind of fill us in and keep us abreast of what's happening in the city of Salem.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Beth.
Take care. Bye.
Ever wish that help with your business was as nearby as your next-door neighbor? At Capan Savings Bank, we're the folks who have helped our neighbors build prosperous communities since 1846. And we invite you to give us a call, discuss your vision, and learn how we can help you grow your business. We're here for you. You have questions. We have answers. Just give us a call, 888-283-CASB, or visit capansavingsbank.com. Member FDIC, DIF, Equal Housing Lender.
Gloucester's Walter Wilkins Insurance Agency is teaming up with Columbia Insurance to deliver a full line of products, personal home and auto policies, as well as a full line of commercial coverage for business owners, including commercial property and commercial vehicle coverage. Wilkins partners with respected companies such as Plymouth Rock, Quincy Mutual, Commerce, and Safeco. For City of Gloucester employees, there are discounts on auto and home policies. Wilkins Insurance is located at 186 Main Street, Gloucester, now partnering with Columbia Insurance, serving the North Shore.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is David DiAcangelo, who is the director of the Massachusetts Office of Disability. David, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, you've been a guest on my shows before, back when I did the Rotary Radio Hour, because we're both Rotarians. But I'm having you on in a slightly different capacity this time on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. So give us a little bit of 3 or 4 minute bio, and then we can talk some more about some of the good work that you do at the state and in the communities.
Well, thanks so much, Josh, and it's great being on again. So it's David DiAcangelo. I'm the director of the Massachusetts Office on Disability, and we're the state agency really that serves as the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act coordinator, for the executive branch of state government. So in that role, we try to ensure independence and self-determination for people with disabilities all across the Commonwealth. And like I said, the number one role is being the ADA coordinator, but I also sit on the state's Architectural Access Board. We also serve as the technical advisor for all of the duly established municipal commissions on disabilities in all the communities across the Commonwealth that have them. And a number of other roles, too, like sitting on the state 911 commission. And we have a client services unit that takes calls from people with disabilities and their families who need assistance, technical assistance, navigating the system or understanding programs as they relate to people with disabilities. Or perhaps they even need somebody to advocate for them, and we can do that as well. So there's a lot of different roles that the Massachusetts Office on Disability does, and really they're all geared towards helping people with disabilities and support dignity and self-determination.
Now, that's great. Now, I know that some cities have disability rights commission. Salem has one, Beverly has one, I believe. Newburyport has one. We just had a city councilor from Newburyport on our show, and we just had the city council president from Salem on our show. I had Jenny Donahue on this fall.
Sure,
was
she's one of our chairs of the Commission on Disability.
On disabilities, and I was very enlightened about some of the intricacies of things that they that need to go be considered in a city or town, up to including, you know, the width of a sidewalk to support someone that's handicapped that might be in a wheelchair, to where the curb cut is and how that impacts someone who may be blind and has a stick and has to be able to feel where they're going when they cross the street. I guess my question to you is, why don't more cities and towns have a disabilities rights commission, and what's the process by which they would establish one?
Sure. So we've been able to add, under Governor Baker's leadership, we've been able to add commissions on disabilities across the Commonwealth. And now, out of the 351 cities and towns, we're up to about 150 duly established commissions on disabilities throughout the Commonwealth. And sometimes they are those disability rights commissions, which we try to go into those communities and persuade them or try to get them to turn them into actual duly established commissions on disabilities. And the way to do that is to get the local governmental body. So in a city, it would be either the Board of Aldermen or the City Council. And in a town, it's usually town meeting, and there's a process there. So depending upon if it's a city or a town, really what has to happen is somebody needs to sponsor it and adopt the provision of Massachusetts General Law. It's actually Mass General Law, Chapter 40, Section 8J. So it's a local option that the city or town puts on their docket and votes on, and then once the legislative body approves that, in cities it would go to the mayor, and in the towns the town meeting would vote on it, and it would get approved, hopefully. And then once it's approved, you'd appoint members, and then your Commission on Disability would be up and running. And just how you, the way I would envision it for your listeners is, so picture the planning board or the board of appeal or the zoning board or all the different boards that are present on the local level. Think of the Commission on Disability as your local disability board, and really they try to inform the leadership of the municipality, of the city or town, on these particular issues that you just mentioned regarding disability laws and policies and regulations, because there is quite a few on the federal level, on the state level, federal laws, state laws, federal regulations, state regulations. So it can get involved, particularly when you start talking about some of like the architectural pieces that you mentioned and things like that. And of course, in Massachusetts, we have our own specialized state building code, 521 CMR. So that adds another layer to it too. So I guess the point is, if you can get some subject matter experts, which these commissions on disabilities really serve as people with disabilities, by the way, the majority of the COD needs to be people with disabilities who serve. So putting those subject matter experts in place, they can really help provide that technical assistance to the local leadership to be able to make sure all the obligations that cities and towns have are being completed.
Now, there's funding for these commissions, and if I'm correct, and how does that come about? How do cities or towns either generate or tap into money that they could use to improve handicap accessibility across their particular area?
Sure. So really, there's another piece of Mass General Law, too. So let's just say that the city or town adopts Mass General Law, Chapter 40, Section 8J. That establishes the COD. What they can then do is use another provision of Chapter 40, Section 22G. And what that does is it sets up an account so that the proceeds from all disability parking fines can go into that account. And that account is established for the sole purpose of benefiting improvements for people with disabilities throughout the city or town. So if you're a place, if you're a city or town that has a big, shopping mall, and there's a lot of HP parking there or disability parking there, and unfortunately, those violations happen. Well, those violations can total hundreds of dollars each infraction. That money can then go into an account that the COD can direct. The COD can then make recommendations, and then that local city or town legislative body can vote on that and use those dollars for things like better ramps or curb cuts or signage or assistive listening devices in the town hall or better striping and the whole myriad of things that could improve access for people with disabilities.
Great. Now, I know that when I was involved in public administration years ago as a school operations manager, you had to read volumes of stuff about what the codes were. And I think back then for a high school, it was for every 25 parking spaces, you had to have one or two handicap spots. Is that still the standard? And does it vary between and how much variance is there or leeway is there? For example, would it be that way in a local mall? Would it be that way at the town hall? Or, you know,
these are all great questions. So let me first start and say, anybody who has any questions, please contact our office. We're there as a resource. We're your state government working for you. You can find us online, mass.gov/MOD, and we'd be very pleased to have a dialogue with anybody about any of these things, because it can get a little bit technical.
Sure.
Let me say generally, yes, there are policies and procedures in place to ensure that disability parking is, there is a table, a use table in 521 CMR, which again is the state regulation for the accessibility code that we have here in Massachusetts. And that use table is indicated by the amount of overall spots, and you know, there's a number of factors there. So rather than speak to a particular, for instance, I would just say most of these things come down to being a case-by-case basis, because it's going to be dependent upon if you're a municipal facility, it's going to be a little bit different than if you're a public facility. So the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, Title II of the ADA is that of the obligations for state and local government. Title III of the ADA is that for public accommodations, and that's public buildings. So those are two different standards there. So Title II naturally has higher obligations that are more intense, and you know, the situation is going to be a little bit different than you're talking about your local movie theater or your shopping center.
Okay, great. What are some of the other things that you get involved with in your capacity as a director?
Yeah, so really, again, it's we provide technical assistance to cities and towns, to individuals, to groups. Really, whoever comes calling, we try to be the keeper of all of the disability laws and regulations and policies and procedures, because they can be so involved. That's where we come in to provide that technical assistance. So it's everything from emergency preparedness. Like I mentioned, we're on the State 911 Commission, sitting on the Architectural Access Board. So all a wide gamut of issues, really anything that impacts people with disabilities. Let's remember that people with disabilities, depending upon how you define it or what data you look at, is somewhere between 12 and 20% of the whole population. So it's our brothers and sisters, it's our neighbors, and it's, you know, really everybody. I'm sure every one of your listeners either has a disability or knows somebody with a disability. So it's the largest minority group of people in the state. So we really try to ensure that all the laws and regulations and policies and procedures that are in place, that we can help try to provide technical assistance to make sure that they're being upheld and that people with disabilities have access and opportunities to take part in all the things that everybody wants them to.
So let me give you a hypothetical. Let's say that the city of Gloucester, let's say that I wanted to, or maybe even an elected official said, why don't we have a disability rights commission? They would have to propose that to the city council. The city council would accept it under the statutes and sections that you referenced. And would your office then come down and talk with the city council about what that involves? Or?
Sure. Oftentimes that's what we've been doing, is trying to generate these commissions on disabilities. Is we'll go in and we'll talk to the local leadership there, whether it be the city councilors or the mayor or town meeting members or town managers, and really try to say to them, hey, look, it's in people in your city and town's best interest to have this level of organization. It's going to benefit not only the people with disabilities, but the whole city and town. You know, the rising tide will lift all ships. And then if and when somebody sponsors it and it gets passed, yes, we go in and provide that technical assistance training with members of the city or town and the, you know, kind of the elected officials and the powers that be, and really who's ever interested. Everything we do is public, so we want to try to get as many people as we can out to the events when we do it. We have a regional commission on disability meetings that anybody's welcome to attend, and we've had prospective communities that may not have yet formed one, but are interested in forming one. We encourage them to come to the meetings to see what it's all about.
Great. That's wonderful. What And so once the city council passes the initiative, assume they pass it, then they the mayor in our hypothetical example, Gloucester, the mayor of Gloucester would have to appoint a commission and.
So just like any other piece of legislation, it needs a sponsor, and then it needs to go through the committee process and get voted on. And if it gets approved, it then needs to go in front of the executive, usually the mayor, to be signed off on. And if the mayor and, you know, everybody signs off on it, well, then it becomes your local ordinance. It gets ordained. And then it's time to appoint the members.
Okay.
And the law was changed, actually, a couple of years ago. It used to be 5 to 9 members. Now it's 5 to 13 members.
Okay.
And again, Mass General Law, Chapter 40, Section 8J, outlines the particulars for each city or town. But a majority of the members should be people with disabilities. So oftentimes we see CODs, Commissions on Disabilities, that are formed with 9 members. You know, and at least in that instance, at least 5 of them would need to be people with disabilities. And and then once they get up and running, they really start talking about all the disability issues in the city and town. And you know, hey, there was never a curb cut right in front of City Hall. Let's get a curb cut right in front of City Hall so people can pull right up and wheel right up. Or there's not assistive listening devices in Town Hall, so somebody who is deaf of hard of hearing couldn't really take part in the town meeting, you know. Or there wasn't large print available, or the website wasn't accessible for visually impaired. So the whole host of issues encompassing all people with disabilities. So oftentimes people think that people with disabilities, and they think of the symbol on that automatic door opener, the person in a wheelchair. Well, yeah, sure, that's a person with a disability, but it's also the other prevalence types as well. So that's people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, people who are blind or deaf or cognitive disabilities. So the whole host of disabilities. So I encourage the people, when they think of disability, to not just think of one thing, but really the whole host of issues that people may encounter. And also remember that data indicates that somewhere between 25 and 40% of people with disabilities are not necessarily seen as people with disabilities, meaning when you meet them or you come upon them, they don't necessarily present as a person with a disability. Again, those are rough estimates we have from various polling, but I guess the point is to not have a preconceived notion about what somebody should or shouldn't look like or can or cannot do. We want to treat people equally and give everybody access and opportunity, particularly when it's in public realm that we're talking about with cities and towns and all the programs and services offered. We've got to ensure that those programs and services that are offered by our local governments are completely available and accessible to all people.
Well, great. And I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be a guest on Trending Now with Josh Adel. I know that we've talked many times. You also know my wife, Teresa, very well. Appreciate your help here, and I hope our listeners had a good session with you, and perhaps it'll spur more activity coming up.
Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. Again, if anybody has any questions, please reach out to us, mass.gov/MOD.
Thanks for
having me on.
Thanks, David. Bye.
Alrighty then, another quick hour.
Yeah, flew by.
Now, I'm not sure of our schedule. This is, what's today? Today, the 9th?
9th. We're off next week.
We're off next week, which, and then the following week is school vacation week, so we'll be off that week.
Okay.
And then I think we're off the following week as well. So I think we're going to be off the next 3 weeks.
Okay.
Because I have something scheduled at the end of the month. So.
Okay, alright.
Alright, so probably takes care of it for February, but good show today. But who you been talking to?
A whole range of people. Want to get some people in talking about the opioid crisis and how that's some of the approaches people are taking with that. Some educators, some people running for office. And,
Okay. All right.
And hopefully a couple of authors.
Very good.
Okay.
That's Josh Arnold. This is Trending Now with Josh Arnold. I'm Rick Moore, our producer and engineer, as always, Bill Proposky. Have a great day.